So this talk is a summary of research done over the years with many collaborators, some of them undergraduate students, some of them colleagues at the University of Washington. And I will acknowledge them more while we go through the talk, but also because this is a talk about dependent data. Part of it will be less emphasizing my own research as showing all the research in a new light, in the light of dependencies versus independencies in ranked data. So these are some kind of ranked data that are available. Here I have chosen data where people express preferences, but sometimes you can see that search engines produce ranked data, and there is a very large amount of that kind of data. So remain aware that this is a problem where data is growing very fast, and it's maybe not the most prevalent kind of data, but still it is worth your attention. This data set is permutation over 6 items. These items are the way burgers are done, and everybody, like, this is an interesting set in the sense that only 600 people gave their complete rankings over how they like burgers. A more interesting set is also with a small number of alternatives or items is the presidential election in Ireland. Many elections in Ireland are done by, in a way that is different from the United States, by what's called a single transferable vote. And part of that process is that voters express a list of complete or incomplete overall candidates. This is a sample, a collected sample of only about 1,000 people from the population. But what we observe is that actually the rankings are not complete, not all complete. This is another data set coming from Ireland as well. These are the applications to college for all the candidates going to college in 2000, there are 50,000 of them. And again, they express their preferences by ranking their top 10 choices. However, there are a lot more than 10 colleges that are, or degree programs. There are about 500 degree programs, or this is how many there were in 2000. And again, this list, so here we see a list of 10 or less out of 500 possible. What is interesting about ranking data? For me, it is interesting that it poses problems that are require combinations of combinatorics, of statistics, and of algebra, and of algorithms and computer science to solve them and to understand actually the space of permutations. And a lot of my talk will be spent, a lot of time in the talk will be spent on describing the algebraic structure or combinatorial structure of permutations that gives rise to interesting statistical properties. But even if you choose to ignore the combinatorial structure, it remains that we have discrete many-valued data sets, and these are difficult. Here is a sample, a token problem, just to hang a good part of the rest of the talk on. Suppose that we have a data set like this. A question we may ask is, what's the consensus ranking? What's the ranking that closes to all the to all the votes expressed by people? Is there something like this? And the possible consensus ranking is this one. I put a question mark because some of you may disagree. And you can see already that, of course, this is only over these 3 samples. The true ranking, if I looked at the whole data set, that would be a different consensus ranking. So some of you would disagree already that this is the consensus. Maybe by counting different ways, we can switch some of the middle candidates or even the top. You may also question whether there is consensus in the Irish population or not. And this is a statistical question, and we'd like to examine it later. So keep in mind this example as we go through the mathematical definition. In a more mathematical sense, finding the consensus is finding some permutation that is closest on average to the data. And closeness depends on the distance, and here we're going to use what's called the Kendall tau distance in statistics. Computer scientists like to call it the bubble sort distance, and in combinatorics, it's called the inversion distance. I prefer the inversion distance, and I will use it throughout the talk because it reflects better the fact that this is a special distance with combinatorial properties, based on the combinatorial rather than vector representation of the permutation. I will try within 3 seconds to convince you that this is relevant. It appears not only in voting, it appears in other decision-making tasks where various panels of experts have to combine preferences. It appears in automatic data aggregation and automatic data analysis. And it appears as sub-problem of other problems. For instance, if we want to build a good search engine, as it was done by Cohen, Shapiro, and Singer in a sort of seminal paper dating from more than 10 years ago, this problem was an inner loop, sort of a small inner loop of this. And in fact, it's not, if we look at it in a statistical way, this is just finding the mean or the median of the data, and it should be a very basic problem and should appear everywhere. However, if we think statistically, we know that to summarize a distribution by the mean is only the first step. And we should want maybe to ask questions of more depth, like what is the dispersion of the distribution, or building a statistical model, a complete statistical model over the data. By the way, this problem is NP-hard, which means that there is no polynomial time solution to this problem. However, this is the problem that will be the center of the talk, if not the only problem in the talk. We'll generalize it, as I said, through estimation of a statistical model instead of just finding the mean. And we'll generalize it with two more interesting data, where we can have very large number of items like the college rankings, and we observe only the first few preferences. This is how the talk will proceed. I'll give an overview of statistical models for permutations in general, then and discuss what are the difficulties with them, and then I'll focus on a model called the Mellows model, which actually avoids many of the difficulties. And it avoids them because it solves the problem of dependence of ranks that I'm going to explain. I'll talk about the maximum likelihood estimation for this model. I'm going to talk about generalizations to different kinds of data, top T rankings. And I hope to have enough time to talk in some detail about statistical results and to show an example of how these algorithms work on data and these estimation algorithms work on data. First, some notation. I'm going to call the set over which we observe the permutations a base set, and the ABCD will be called items. I prefer to denote them by letters as it makes the talk shorter. SN is the symmetric group, the set of all permutations, and we have permutations expressed here in the list notation, and top T permutations, which are just the truncated prefixes of permutations. And we are going to observe that data that typically is assumed to be sampled IID from some unknown permutation. This is our estimation problem. However, even if we do observe IID data, we shall see that there is dependence in a permutation itself, dependence between what we observe at every rank. So this data point is actually a complex object that we are observing. And that's where the dependence lies. These are 6 ways of expressing representing a permutation. I have a friend in the math department who knows a dozen ways of expressing a permutation. We are going to use out of these only a few. Ranked list will be easier for notation and a natural way. Another way to represent a permutation is the precedence matrix, where we have a 1 in the matrix if item I is before item j in a permutation, in the permutation, and we'll come back to it. And we have these lesser known representations called the codes, which will be important and which I will discuss in detail. Now, a little about existing statistical models. One of the oldest and most studied and important models is the Thurstonian model, which is a utility-based model. Basically, each item is described by an expected utility. And what we observe which actually is instantiated with noise, which could be independent or not. Typically, it's actually normal Gaussian noise. And what we observe is the sorting order of the utilities, and that is that's the permutation. This is a generative model for the permutation. This is a very rich model class. Any distribution can be modeled this way. Any distribution over the symmetric group can be modeled this way. And it's very rich, even if you restrict the epsilons to be normal and independent. The parameters are naturally interpretable because they are expectations and noise in the utility. However, if we actually want to analyze this model probabilistically, for instance, to get the probability of this presidential candidate to be on rank 5, that may be easy if we have only 5 ranks, but it becomes intractable as we have more ranks, like 85 or 185 or so, because it all these analyses refer to the order statistics of a set of Gaussian distributions, and so we have to take convolutions of various kinds of Gaussian CDFs. And so while looking at the first rank and at the pairwise preferences is tractable, many other things that we'd like to compute are intractable under this model. And the source of the intractability is the fact that each rank of pi depends on all the epsilons. So there is a very dense dependent structure in this model, even if you pick this epsilon to be normal. Notice that in general, if you look at a permutation as a list ABCD, there will be dependence between the ranks, because if A is on the first position, it means that it can't be anywhere else in the list. So if you look at the graph of dependency in a permutation, it's very dense. The Plunkett-Lewis model is another very natural and intuitive model for rankings, which has the flavor of a Markov generative process. So each item has a weight, which is its chance of being a winner. And so the first item is sampled with a probability proportional to its weight. Then we exclude the weight of the sampled item when renormalized and sample the second item proportional to the weights. And then we proceed recursively until you have a permutation. This is a nice generative model also for top P permutations, because it marginalizes naturally by omitting the tail. However, when you try to analyze this model and predict what's the probability that an item is on rank 85, that is a hard problem. That is intractable. In fact, even the normalization constant is not known for this model. However, there are some approximations. So what is easy to approximate is, if there are many items, if the list is long, then the first few items are approximately independent. That can be done easily. But looking at the distribution sort of under different angles is hard. And again, this is because there are dependencies and many. Each rank J depends on all previous ranks, on all past, or all past ranks. A third interesting model and a third perspective on permutations is penalizing inversions. And this is done in the Bradley-Terry model, which is actually was popular and still is in other areas of machine learning as classification, where we want to transform from pairwise classification to multi-way classification. This is an avenue of doing so. However, this is an exponential family model which has a parameter alpha for every pair ij, and qij are these 0, 1 numbers that tell us whether I is before j or after j. And so if alphas are positive, then for each qij equal 1, so if I is before j, I win, and if I invert, I lose. So you would say it's a very natural model. And I say so as well. However, it's not easy to analyze quantitatively. So what we know, and I'm not joking, what we know is that if we increase alpha, we decrease the probability of an inversion between I and J. But that's all we can say about how alpha predicts that probability. It's not easy. I mean, it's intractable to derive the normalization constant. It's intractable to derive marginals. What's the probability of Qij of an inversion? And so on. Even though the model looks simple, and that's again because we have dependencies, The dependencies are given by transitivity. If ing is before j and j is before k, then I is before k as well. So if we have two inversions here, we'll have a third. And so we should penalize the first two, but perhaps not the third, because this would be overcounting. So the number of free parameters in the model are not the same as the number of parameters that we see. And this is the cause for the intractability of the model. And I hope I stressed enough that intractability means it's hard to compute, but it's also hard to interpret. However, by a very simple trick, in fact, by reducing the number of parameters, by tying some of these parameters, we get to a class of models called Mallows model, which do not suffer from this dependence. And this is what I'm going to talk about next. But first, I have to introduce some mathematics, some combinatorics. So we start with a simple list representation of a permutation. And then we can go to this precedence matrix representation where, again, as I said, one represents the fact that A is before C in this permutation pi. Yes? But it's not before B and D. And this is a skew symmetric matrix centered about 1/2. I have represented Q here by sorting the columns and rows in the order A, B, C, D. But this is just a convention. I can sort the columns by any order. And we'll call that ordering the reference permutation. We'll get to it in a moment. Now, from this matrix, it's easy to see that we can get the number of inversions in a permutation. By the way, the lower triangle of the matrix completely determines the upper triangle. That's obvious. If we define the number of inversions as the number of ways, pairwise transpositions that bring my permutation CABD to the identity ABCD. This is the sum of the ones in the lower triangle. So the identity permutation will have 0 in the lower triangle and 1 in the upper triangle. Let me see if there are questions. I don't want to lose you right now. Maybe after 10 minutes. Maybe. Okay. So the number of inversions is the distance between pi and the identity. And as I said, we can use any other reordering of the columns. Let's do that. So here I have reordered the rows and the columns by another reference permutation, this one. Now the lower triangle measures the distance between pi and this new reference permutation. So I can express the inversion distance between two permutations instead of counting inversions as summing in elements in a matrix. Okay, and now I'm actually going to hammer it in by saying if I want to obtain the distance, one algorithm, I'm not saying this is the best, is to construct the precedence matrix to sort the rows and columns by the reference permutation, and then do the sum over the lower triangle. What's nice about this is that it can be applied to the distances of a set of matrices to the same reference permutation, pi 0. If I want the sum of these distances, I have to sum the precedence matrices and then do the same operation. So I would just stack up all the Q matrices from several permutations and pi 1 through pi n, a data set, for instance, and then summing the lower triangle will give me what is the objective that I'm going to want to minimize if I want to do consensus ranking. That's the value of this algorithm, its conceptual value. Now let's go one step further. Let's decompose this inversion distance into inversions with respect to this B. So how many inversions do I have to do to get B on the first place? Then inversions with respect to A. How many inversions do I have to do after getting B to get A on the second place, and so on. And I denote each of these numbers by V. Vj refers to the rank in the permutation. So it's not V, B, A, and D, as it could be, but it's just it has a rank index. Well, it turns out that these numbers are given by the columns of the precedence matrix Q. So A is preceded only by, so this is this is the number of inversions I have to do to transform pi into the identity. Well, A is on the second rank because it's preceded only by C, so I have to do one inversion, so V1 is 1. B is preceded by only one element, C, so I have to do one inversion to get B in its place, and so on. By the way, the last one is 0 by the time I've sorted the n minus 1 elements, the last one is in place. And this is the code. And it should come to no surprise that the code actually can reconstruct the permutation completely. So it's another description, a one-to-one mapping from this list to this list of n minus 1 numbers. The more useful code is actually this row code S, which is read on the rows, and it refers to ranks. And I'm going to, for the sake of getting through further, I was going to skip how S is constructed. But it has exactly the same properties of T. In fact, it's the distance between the inverses. And again, it should come to no surprise that I can change the reference permutation and get codes with respect to another reference permutation, which will be different, because they have to, in part because they have to sum to the distance between pi and pi zero. And again, they can be computed from by S or by Z. Are there questions? So this is my theory part, or my combinatorics tutorial. I'll go to the next page. Just to summarize what I said before, and one of the points is that the distance between two permutations is either the sum of the V codes or the sum of the S codes, or the sum in the lower triangle of the precedence matrix after I sort the rows and columns. But the most important fact is that the codes represent pi uniquely. It's an injection. And it's very easy to see that V can take values from 0 to n minus 1 because there are n minus 1 positions where it could be 1 or 0. The second one can take up to n from 0 to n minus 2 and so on. So if I add them up, I have n times n minus 1 times n minus 2 and so on, n factorial degrees of freedom. So I have exactly n factorial numbers. And they're independent in the sense that I can choose, I don't have to see the precedence matrix. I can just choose these numbers any way I want in their domains and get back a permutation. So if I parameterize my permutation by these, I have eliminated the problem of dependence between ranks. That's why I spent so much time explaining to them, because this is the key to the code. It's a description of a permutation with independent parameters. Of the many others that could be, that exist, this is the one that actually gives the n minus 1 independent numbers that completely describe the permutation. And we'll exploit this it can be exploited in many, many ways, algorithmically and statistically. So how do we exploit it? Well, we construct an exponential family model, and that is the Mallows model. The probability of a permutation is exponentially decaying with the distance to some central permutation pi 0, and if this data is strictly greater than 0, then pi 0 is the mode of the unique mode of the permutation. If theta is 0, you get a uniform distribution. Because we can decompose the D into the Vs, and each V has an exponential geometric distribution that's a really simple univariate distribution, we can easily compute a normalization constant. That's a high school trick, more or less. So we know the distribution in closed form. And it's a simple closed form. There is a very natural generalization, which is called the generalized Mallows model. It was introduced by Fliegner and Verducci many years ago now, which is to put a theta parameter, or a theta penalty, before every Vj. Again, the computation of the normalization constant is natural, easy, just as easy. What we gain is a little bit more interpretability and a little bit more degrees of freedom. So we can call the cost the minus log likelihood. And the parameter theta is the cost attached to an inversion at rank j. So we can say that if theta 1 is the largest, it means that we put more weight onto getting the first element of the of pi 0 in its right place, and you penalize more for getting wrong the first element wrong. If then we can set theta 2 a bit smaller than theta 1, it means that we don't attach so much importance to getting the second element wrong. And if we put a theta that's very small, it means that for that item, it's not very important where it is, as long as it is in the available places after the others, the further one has been placed. There is a similar interpretation for the S models, but it goes by ranks and not by items. The penalty for getting the rank wrong instead of the item wrong. All right, so let's go now to how to estimate these models, and I start with maximum likelihood estimation. In fact, there's much to understand if we look at maximum likelihood, and so I spent some time here too. It was known for a long time that if we know the central permutation, we have to estimate some parameters in a geometric distribution and the problem is simple. It was, has been always known for a long time that if we have a single theta, we get to the NP-hard consensus ranking. What is new? Well, it was, if we have multiple theta, that's not, can't be easier than estimating a single parameter theta, because that's a superclass of models. But what we are going to show is that it's not harder either. So theta behave like nuisance parameters from the point of view of estimation. It's the pi zero that is hard to estimate. Why is it hard? This slide shows why. And it's enough, instead of parsing the slide, to just look at the colors here. So this is the log likelihood of a data set. Here are the data. This is theta and this is pi zero. So theta enters linearly. If I fix pi zero, then theta enters, in a convex function. Well, this is a convex term and this is a linear term, so it's really natural, easy to estimate. Not in closed form, but numerically. And it's true here as well, because we have n minus one separate estimations. However, if we look at where pi zero enters through these VJs, which change from one data point to the next, and then they are averaged, and these are the sufficient statistics for pi zero. That's a much harder, much more complicated relation. And that's what makes the problem NP-hard. This slide says what can be done. It's a summary of the algorithm that I'm going to present. So I'm going to present an algorithm that solves this part of the problem, that pi zero can be found exactly by a branch and bound search on the precedence matrix. And then while I go over very fast, this algorithm can be extended to sufficient statistics for the other cases. For instance, when we have multiple parameters, or when we have truncated data, or when we have truncated data from an infinite set of alternatives and multiple parameters, and so on. However, I said this is an exact algorithm, and I said that the problem is NP-hard, so what we expect is that the search may not always be tractable. And we'll talk also about the cases when it will be tractable, or what makes it more tractable and what makes it less tractable. This problem has sufficient statistics. And this slide shows what the sufficient statistics are. This is the precedence matrix for one permutation. This is the precedence matrix of a large sample from a Mallows model summed over and now represented in color, with dark red being 1 and dark blue being 0. And by the way, all the matrices are on the same color scale. Yes. So this is a matrix full of numbers close to 0.5. Notice that this was generated from a theta that's almost, it's close to uniform. And that's what we see. This was generated from a theta equal 1. Now, the value 1 doesn't mean much, but the picture tells us what it means. It tells us that basically, if we see data like this, this should not be a hard problem. So we define the sufficient statistics for the problem, and I haven't proved that they are sufficient statistics, as the sum of the Q matrices of the data, average, divided by N. And now let's remember that if we look only at pi zero, we want the pi zero that the sorting of the rows and columns of the Q matrix that minimizes the sum in the lower triangle. So for instance, this sorting, the identity sorting, minimizes the lower triangle, and any other sorting will bring some dark red in the lower triangle, so it will be, would have larger cost. So here is a matrix of sufficient statistics. This is actually from true data, from a true sample. We want to get the sum here to be as low as possible, so as blue as possible. And we see easily that if we invert these two columns, we actually get this little yellow out of the way and get something smaller there. So let's do that. By the way, let's remember that when we invert two columns, we also invert switch two rows, which actually helps us. Now we are going to look for another, for what to put in the third position, and this seems to be the bluest column. After we have gotten the first two rows and columns, we don't, for the other columns, we eliminate these rows because they are just determined by this area here. So we look only at the submatrix here. And in this submatrix, this column is clearly the winner. So we go on. Then we look in the next submatrix and so on, and you can see the submatrix popping up. And in the end, we get a nicely sorted matrix, and this is the maximum likelihood estimate of pi zero for this data. Now, what I showed is a greedy algorithm. But we can easily generalize to something that's called a branch and bound algorithm, where we remember all the partial solutions and we try all the possible solutions that look promising. And that algorithm is guaranteed to be optimal. It's not that, so this algorithm has n minus one steps. The branch and bound algorithm can have a factorial number of steps if it has to explore more, but it is an exact algorithm. And this is a search tree. Basically, you search for the first column after you choose the after every partial solution that contains the same first column, then can search for the second column, and so on. And at the bottom, we have n factorial leaves. That's why the search could be n factorial. However, in branch and bound, if we have something called admissible heuristics, we can prune some of the branches, and we can reduce the search to much less than n factorial. This slide is a repetition of the previous slide. It just says that a similar branch and bound can be run also when we have a theta parameter attached to each rank. And ask me later if you want to know how it's done. And as you see, a similar branch and bound with a different matrix can be run if we only have partial observations. Just to summarize, no matter whether I have to estimate one theta parameter or multiple, the sufficient statistics are given by the precedence matrix. The algorithm is exact, but it's not always tractable. And because it's a branch and bound algorithm, the most important point is that it's amenable to approximation. So there are many, many studies of how to do branch and bound faster, how to approximate it faster, and how to build admissible heuristics. And some of this work was done by Bush and Mandani in a paper at AIA Stats 2009 on building admissible heuristics for complicated problems. What makes the search hard? Well, there is a part of computing the sufficient statistics that's polynomial but not negligible. And then we work on this matrix, and that's independent of the sample size, but it's dependent on the branching of the tree, how fast you go deep and how much you can prune. And how much you can prune depends on how concentrated is the distribution of the data from which the sample comes from. So if the distribution is almost uniform, then we'll have to try all the permutations because all of them are equally good or almost. So that is the hard case. On the other hand, if the distribution is very concentrated, we'll be able to prune fast, and we'll have a tractable search. In fact, one can prove that if the distribution is concentrated enough, very concentrated, branch and bound defaults to greedy. It's that fast. Yeah? Also, an advantage of doing a branch and bound algorithm is that all these diagnoses can be done online by looking at the structure of the queue of the algorithm and looking at the difference between the one solution and the next and so on. Well, the message of this slide is that admissible heuristics help, and it pays to put work in them because it does accelerate the algorithm. And all the results I'm going to show will be done with the admissible heuristics, and not simply sophisticated admissible heuristics. There is very much related work in models of permutations, and I'm going to sort of be very narrow-sighted and look only at Malus models. And in this case, the work is much less because there are some work by Fligner and Verducci in the past. And some recent work, but that looked mostly at the consensus ranking problem, which has been studied very heavily both in statistics and in social choice, because that's the K-many ranking in social choice. Again, I'm not doing justice to all, I'm just citing here the most relevant and important works. We know by now that the problem is in polynomial time approximable, but this algorithm is not practical. In fact, it hasn't been implemented to date. I want to also say that there is a lot of work in extensions of the Malus model, of the Malus model in other fields, most relevantly in social choice and using preferences. And here are just a few of the works that are related to machine learning, as inferring ranking under aggregated information, which is somehow related to the fact that Q is a matrix of sufficient statistics, so we can aggregate the data by preserve all the information about the distribution. And on vote elicitation under probabilistic model, and this is from here from University of Toronto. I'm told that the building is next door. And also as voting rules viewed as maximum likelihood, an interesting step from social choice towards statistics. This is a computational demonstration of what I said, that if the data is very concentrated, we get an easy algorithm that the running time is short. If the data is almost uniform, well, that may not be an interesting problem because almost any permutation will do as well. And why is this important? Because they are actually, this branch and bound algorithm is an expensive algorithm. The existing other existing algorithms that I glossed over very fast, but some of them are here. This is the border rule discovered by Fligner and Verducci, and this is an algorithm by Depont-Pont and Kalanyanan for consensus ranking, are much faster. However, ours is exact up to theta about here. This is theta, by the way, decreasing exponentially to 10 to the minus 3. So what we see is that at theta equal 1, this easy case, all algorithms find the optimum. So there's no point in using an expensive algorithm like branch and bound. Here, all algorithms are very far in their choices. But then it's really hardly any sense to find the optimal permutation because it would be so sensitive to the sample that it will not have much significance, and the cost also will not have much significance because the difference will be epsilon, really. So again, it won't pay to use an expensive algorithm. So luckily for my publication list, there is this middle ground where it is tractable to use branch and bound. The permutations in this regime are interesting, so the are still meaningful. There is meaningful information to gain from the data, and the difference between branch and bound and the competitors is pretty large. So it pays to work more. We did some extensive experiments with Al-Nurali from Microsoft on a very large data set, very long permutations of a few hundreds. And we compared with other competitors, which are a very simple algorithm, local search, that just does bubble sort as long as it can, or starting from a different model. And what we see is that basically we got into, so this is the board account, this is the very simplest algorithm here for reference, and these are the sophisticated algorithms, much lower cost, much larger time, 100 times more. What we found is that branch and bound and local search are kind of in an arms race. So it's not so much about the theoretical possibilities at this stage. It's more about how you can exploit the implementation. So both of them are competitive. And it may depend on the structure of the data, and it may depend on how you implement them. Ours was in Java, so it wasn't the fastest implementation. I want to review the statistical model of rankings that I have reviewed before. Here is the Malus model. It's an exponential model over the weeds, over the code. It's a subclass of the Bradley-Terry model. And here are the Plackett-Lewis and the Thurston. And this summarizes what I said before, that in various coordinates, like normalization constant, parameter estimation, tractable marginals, and interpretability of the parameters, the general Mellows model is a clear winner in the sense that it's more interpretable and more tractable. It also has a very interesting statistical property. It's the only one that actually requires a discrete parameter, pi zero. All the other models do not require, have only continuous parameters. And that's nice because you have a smooth model and, you know, you have much of the statistical theory, these being parametric models. When you want to actually look at the statistical properties of the models, it's a great gain to have a model that depends smoothly on the parameters. You can't do the same statistics with when the parameter is a permutation instead of a real number or a vector. And that's one direction of research with my students, to actually do that kind of statistics. However, this sort of added difficulty in mathematical technicality is paid off by the models that we get, which are very useful, of course, if they are appropriate for the data. Now I'm going to go to looking at truncated data. 15 minutes? Yes? Okay. So how about truncated data and infinite number of items? These are examples of this kind of data. We'd like to be able to model them with Mellows model. And here there is a distinction between what I said, between models based on the S codes and models based on the V codes. It turns out that for the S codes, it's easy to express the marginal when I truncate the first t ranks, whereas that's not so easy for the V models. And it turns out that these models have sufficient statistics, whereas these don't. This doesn't mean that they're bad in other ways, perhaps, but all the estimations I've done can't be done on the Q matrix. We'd have to go and recompute the statistics as we do the estimation. So it will be a lot more costly. Why is that? Because if I observe permutations up to rank T, then the numbers ST, which are here on the rows, notice that I have some question marks. If I don't observe one item, B for instance, I do not know. I know that it's past all the other items that are observed, but we don't know its relation to other items that are not observed. Yeah? And this actually messes up my Vs, but it doesn't mess up the Ss because Ss are all either completely determined or completely undetermined. So this says that this S is zero or larger. That's complete indetermination. Yeah? And therefore, this marginal has a very simple form. Instead of multiplying from 1 to n minus 1, we multiply up to t. Now, what happens if I have an infinite number of items? Well, that's simple. My normalization constant is the sum of the infinite geometric distribution, so it gets a bit simpler. I'm skipping over a lot of details, but the details are not so difficult. It turns out that this model, which has a product of 1 to t, and has this v, which is the sum of the infinite geometric series, is a true marginal of over all the distributions, the infinite distribution that start with a given set of items. Yes? By the way, the space of all infinite permutations is not countable. But if we truncate them to a finite t, to a bounded t, then it is count. So we get marginals that are well defined and non-zero. So what we get is that we get a model that's slightly more difficult probabilistically, but is simpler mathematically, interestingly enough. We can show that there are sufficient statistics, even if we truncate the permutations. Again, this is new work. It wasn't known before. And the sufficient statistics have the similar flavor for every item j. For every rank j, I have to look at how many items are before that rank in the permutation, and that is my sufficient statistics. So these are typical sufficient statistics matrices for truncated permutation. You see that there are these areas which are sort of very weak because I have little information there as the matrix is truncated. Note that These sufficient statistics don't necessarily compress the data. These are very sparse matrices with lots of zeros. So I may have more space or a bigger representation for the sufficient statistics than for the data themselves. Also notice that even if my model is over an infinite set of, over an uncountable set, as long as I observe a finite sample, everything is finite. And here is a theorem that describes the sufficient statistics, which are precedence matrices penalized for the fact that I only observe up to t items, so that the fact that so basically these are not q is not the unbiased count of probability of observing a precedence. It's biased by the fact that sometimes a pair is not observed. We also gain something minor. We have a nice closed form estimator for the theta, but we still have to estimate pi zero. That is the hard part, and that is done by a branch and bound algorithm on the matrix R. And that is true even if you have multiple parameters theta, except that this is the only case where we can guarantee a global optimum. We only find a local optimum by the branch and bound method. Here are some experiments on artificial data. I postponed the ones on real data to a slightly more complex model. And there's some interesting thing. There is a bias here in the estimation of the parameter of theta. In a few seconds, I would like to see, usually I ask the audience to guess why do I have a bias. But now, since I want to get a little further and show you some experiments on real data, I will tell you that this is the same bias that we observe when we estimate the mean and sigma of a Gaussian distribution. Oh, we all know that the maximum likelihood estimation of the dispersion is biased towards more concentrated value. And the bias is 1 over n. Yeah? It's the same phenomenon here. The theta is slightly more biased in the maximum likelihood framework. And the bias is also, this being not a variance but a dispersion in a geometric, is the bias is 1 over square root of it. So it decays with the sample size. These models have sufficient statistics, so naturally they are exponential family models with discrete and continuous parameters. So naturally we should think of their conjugate priors, and the conjugate priors are, as usual, equivalent sample size and equivalent sufficient statistics. Here is, not very surprisingly, this is how the prior looks like, the conjugate prior looks like. Unfortunately, we cannot compute this normalization constant in closed form. It doesn't have an analytic form, the integration over the parameters itself. Can we do Bayesian inference? Well, we can write the posterior up to normalization constant. The summary is that whenever the normalization constant is involved, we don't know how to do it. But whenever it's not involved, we can do it because the rest is a very simple expression. So map estimation, sampling, well, sampling is not always possible, efficiently or fast. But model averaging and things that involve the normalization constant are a bit more difficult and not always tractable. One thing that one does with Bayesian estimation is to consider the possibility that there are clusters in the data, and that there are clusters with an unknown number of clusters or a non-parametrically growing number of clusters in the modeled by the Dirichlet process mixture. We'd like to actually, because we are trying to model data where we expect to have clusters, like the preferences for college programs or voters or even burger preferences and other data, we expect to have clusters. We expect that if the sample size is large, we would like to use a non-parametric method. By the way, the EM and others have been implemented too. And the question is, can we do it? When it comes to Monte Carlo, most of the time we can do it. The question is, can we do it efficiently on a large data set? And this is what I'm going to talk about. This slide is just a tutorial on clustering with Dirichlet process mixtures. I want to say that the algorithm we implemented comes from Toronto, from a long time ago. This is our algorithm, or the particular algorithm in the case of mixture models, and it has two stages. How many of you are familiar actually with Dirichlet process mixtures and fitting? So only a few admit it. So this proceeds in two steps. Once the parameters of the clusters are fixed, so the points are reassigned probabilistically. And the second stage, where the assignments of the points to clusters are fixed, and the parameters of the clusters are re-estimated, or resampled, in fact. Most of the operations here are intractable, but we do a few tricks to make them tractable. And one of them is to approximate the set of items which is finite, in our case, although it's 500, it's finite, with an infinite distribution. And as I said, in the infinite distribution, some of the things can be done faster. Also, we choose an improper prior and a uniform prior over the permutations, and that also simplifies some calculations. Now, a uniform prior is... let's go on one step. An uninformative prior over pi 0, which is actually the right thing to do for many situations, is improper, and ask me later why this is not a problem. And I'm going to go through a set of lemmas. You don't need to parse them. I want to just show how nicely the fact that we go to the infinite case allows us to compute in closed form certain quantities that are difficult, and so collapse the Gibbs sampler to something that is reasonably promising to mix well. Yes. So in particular, we can compute the posterior for one sample, and that's always the same. It has the mean in the sample and the variance that's given by the prior itself. And that's one reason why the improper prior is not doesn't cause any problems, is because for even one observation, it becomes proper and it's very well behaved. Okay, this is an approximation, and what I'm showing now is an approximate Dirichlet process mixture sampler. This is with artificial data, and the clusterings are on the horizontal line, and those long stripes means that the mixing has been very fast for this artificial data with 15 clusters. But I want to skip to the real data sets. Here is the presidential election, and this has been studied before. We obtain a clustering, and this clustering shows that actually there are blocks of voters in the electorate. That's not surprising. What I want to say is that we are actually discussing in Murphy and Gormley, because our results are completely different from theirs. So we do not get the same cluster. This is not the same with the college admissions, where we do get a result in agreement. Gormley and Murphy produced this data, and they also analyzed it with EM mixture of Plunkett-Lewis models with an approximate EM, because EM is not tractable for their data set. I want to say that this is a big debate every year, or a big discussion every year in Ireland. Is this system broken? Is it ruining children's lives, young people's lives, and so on? So here are some headlines. We implemented this algorithm and ran it on this data set with 50,000, on the whole data set. And here are is a summary of the results. We did only one tuning because Murphy and Gormley found around 20 clusters. We chose a granularity parameter that gives us about the same number of clusters. What we found is about 30 clusters, and these are the cluster sizes, whereas these are the cluster parameters, with white being larger, more concentrated. And the dark red being less concentrated. I have truncated them to a level of significance. Not all the parameters are significant. The first clusters are very large. They're in the thousands. So the largest is 4,000 people. The smallest is 4 people, and all the others are 1 and 2. But if we look at actually, I have included it because it's actually a significant cluster. It's a group of... So this is a clustering of the programs. It's a group of 4 programs that do home economics. And so there are some people who only want to do home economics. They created this cluster. These are the interpretations of some of the clusters. Again, this is mostly Brendan Murphy's work, because all I saw were the codes of the programs. And we found what they found too, except we found slightly more, our model was slightly more analyzable, had been a full posterior. We found what they found too, which is that people in Ireland choose both by field and by location. So some people want to stay home and some people don't want to stay home, essentially. And of course they do choose by genders, by gender, and you know, we can fit different models to the genders as well. In the last minute, one question that is a question of debate on which we learned as well is, does this program actually skew the way people make their choices? I must say that the matching is a stable marriage matching, so people are encouraged. So the best thing you can do is to actually put your true preferences. So we are seeing people's true preferences and not something. But are people trying to get into hard to get programs, which are, you know, what you would expect, law and medical school and so on, or not? And that would be visible if, for instance, there would be clusters of very high point average programs, or if the orderings were actually monotonic with high points higher and low points lower, which means that everybody prefers the harder programs to get in first. And that's what you should do naturally if you want to. If the program with higher points is better for you, that's what you should do, put it on top. Now, if you look at the left, this is the marginal of the points, the average rank of the quantile of the points per rank. And this shows basically that all the ranks are decreasing. So basically, if we don't cluster the data, this is what we see. We see that indeed, programs that are tougher to get in are ranked higher. It, you know, very clearly. However, if we do cluster the data, we see a different picture. We see that that's not at all the case, that this is not, these columns are not monotonic. And in fact, they're not monotonic, you know, beyond the significance level. So these are not just noise fluctuations due to noise. So in fact, we have uncovered a kind of Simpson's paradox, and we can answer a question that is of social interest, that in fact, there's more than just getting to high points, which we are really expecting. Now to wrap up, I spoke about a lot of advantages of the Malus models, and a lot of them are new research. I haven't talked about some of them, like getting confidence intervals and convergence rates for the estimation. I haven't talked also about the fact that we can compute polynomial marginals of various kinds, and sometimes even in closed form. But more importantly, what I'd like to you to take home from here is that the Malus models are the most combinatorial way of are based on the most combinatorial way to represent a permutation by its inversions, and they complement very well in some sense the Torstonian models, which are the utility based, the continuous based representation of permutations. So I don't want to say that these are better; these are definitely more tractable in many respects. I want to say that what is easy to represent by stage-wise models like Malus is not easy to represent in the utility framework with Gaussian distribution. So you need, of course you can do it, but you need complicated distribution and not independent noise, for instance, dependent noise. And even more importantly, all these advantages that I talked about the Malus model come from one simple thing, the fact that of all the representations of permutations, which there is one, the one we used, which gives independent independent parameters. So the advantages come from breaking the dependence between the ranks that is at the core of our natural view of a permutation. The less intuitive view of ranks is the one that actually is correct from the from the understanding of the structure of the space point of view. And moreover, I hope that this will be applied further, that when we have dependent data or data with structure, one needs to look at both statistics, computer science, and algebra and combinatorics, because they work together to allow us to actually compute and estimate the quantities that we want. Thank you very much.